Welcome to the Humble Hoof Podcast. My name is Alicia Harlov. This is a podcast for both horse owners and hoof care professionals, offering discussions into various philosophies on the health of the hoof and soundness of your horse. Please check us out on Facebook or at thehumblehoof.com. A special thank you to our wonderful sponsor, Cavallo. For our Humble Hoof listeners, they are offering 15% off their Cavallo Trek hoof boots using the coupon code HRN at checkout. The Trek is the world's most popular and versatile hoof boot and Cavallo's toughest trail boot, while also doubling as an option for therapy or rehab. The front closure system makes it easily adaptable to various hoof shapes, and the TPU gaiter allows for maximum strength while minimizing weight for the comfort and ease of movement for your horse. These are recommended by vets and trainers and also loved as transport boots by barrel racers, show jumpers, dressage riders, and everyone in between. Again, for 15% off a pair of Treks, use the code HRN at checkout at cavallo-inc.com. If you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, you've probably heard me mention ECIR, or the Equine Cushing's and Insulin Resistance Group. ECIR has been around now for 25 years, and they are putting together a fantastic conference this year, the weekend of October 31st, presenting some of the latest research in regards to equine Cushing's and insulin resistance, and just talking about metabolic issues in general for horses. One of the amazing things, alongside all the great speakers and presenters, is that various hoof care organizations are providing continuing education credit for those members that attend the conference. And RACE is also giving 21 continuing education credits to veterinarians who attend this conference. So it is definitely not only a worthwhile investment because it's great information, but also to log those credits in for those that need them. They are at the head of the game for anything that goes on in the endocrinopathic equine world. I talked with Dr. Eleanor Kellen and Dr. Kathleen Gustafson about some of the topics they'll be broaching when it comes to the conference this year, and just in general, some of the latest things that we're looking at when it comes to management for these horses. To register or see some of the topics online, you can go directly to nolaminitis.org to learn more about their No Laminitis conference. The conference is all virtual, and it is so worth the time and effort to learn some of the most recent and up-to-date information on how to care for these horses, especially as horse owners who have to care for them every day, but not only that, hoof care providers and veterinarians who have to try to work to rehab these cases. Well, thank you so much for both of you for being willing to be on the podcast again and talking about such an important topic, especially this time of year and going into the fall with so many laminitis cases popping up and with the upcoming No Laminitis Conference that has so many great speakers and topics and things that I'm interested to learn more about. So I am really excited to chat about some of the topics that will be covered and what people can expect from the information they might hear when they attend. So I really appreciate you both giving us a bit of a sneak peek into that. So do we want to start a little bit with talking about some of the things that will be addressed in the conference, if that's okay?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Great. Awesome. So Dr. Kellen, why don't we start and talk a little bit about, you know, high insulin, hyperinsulinemia. A lot of my clients that I've been working with have been using the SGLT2 inhibitors, the new medication or the new-ish medication to use in metabolic cases that are struggling with high insulin despite other management changes. And I saw that there's actually a lot of discussion about the SGLT2 inhibitors in this conference. So I was hoping that we could talk a bit about them. Can you tell us a little bit about the SGLT2 inhibitors and how that class of drug works?
Well, it's a very simple principle. They work by stopping the kidney from reabsorbing glucose after it has filtered it out. Normally, there's no glucose in the urine, but these drugs block the reabsorption so that 90% of the glucose that gets filtered through the kidney gets lost. And that decreases the load, obviously, on insulin. And it eventually improves the insulin number. And dropping that number is what we're after, because it's the high insulin that causes laminitis.
And so the insulin is responding to the glucose.
Yes.
Right. So that makes sense. So obviously, if they're excreting the glucose, then their insulin doesn't have anything to respond to.
Right.
That, yeah. And I've seen it work on horses. And it, honestly, I'll say there are horses that were set for euthanasia that it really came in like mm-hmm. a miracle drug. But, you know, is it, I know I've had some vets say that it should just be prescribed to every EMS or insulin resistant horse. But do you think that it should be that first line of defense?
No, I don't. For one thing, it doesn't work as well without the diet already in place. You have to be controlling their diet to some extent. And besides that, there are a number of side effects you have to look out for that we don't have with diet and exercise. And metformin is a more proven, more time-honored approach, and we like to try that first. And if that doesn't work, or if it stops working, as it sometimes does, then we'll go to aflosin. But only if the horse is in danger of laminitis. Or has a laminitis that isn't responding.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, you mentioned the side effects. And I know I have one case that I'm working on right now that actually they had to remove the SGLT2 inhibitor, which is frustrating because it did help comfort. But she dropped weight very quickly. And also her triglycerides just shot up. Just, you know, they just skyrocketed. So can you talk a little bit about that and how you adjust the diet or what the diet protocol is?
We make a number of adjustments to correct that, or at least minimize it. It's a very wide spectrum of what they need in terms of calories. Some horses can stay on the same diet they were on before, but that's a very small minority. Most of them, horses, ponies, whatever, need to increase their caloric intake. And I try to do that with safe calories. So we might take the base diet they were on and just make it free choice hay. Make sure they get at least 1 pound of beef pulp per 500 pounds body weight. Because beef pulp is fermented to acetate, and acetate can enter directly into energy pathways and substitute for glucose. So it's not directly a one-to-one. Glucose provides two points of entry into the cycles. An acetate only one, but it's still it's a good way to keep energy flowing in the horse. And what creates that triglyceride release is the loss of the glucose and the energy crisis that in turn creates. That triggers release of glucose, of triglycerides. The same thing happens when there's long-term exercise or starvation, even overnight not eating. It's different from the hypertriglyceridemia that ponies and minis get that can kill them very rapidly. This is different from that. It can go on for a long period of time. They don't lose their appetite as a rule. They stay bright. A lot of times that you don't even know what's going on unless somebody does the blood work. But you can prevent it and prevent the liver enzyme elevations that go along with it. By changing the diet, like I mentioned, we also use things like carnitine and glycine to help get the fat utilized and also to help the pathways that generate glucose when it's too low. So there are other things, too, that can be tried, but I'll be going into that at the conference. Those are the four main things.
Yeah, and I know that, you know, it's been interesting to see this kind of follow along with the kind of introduction of the drugs and then seeing it become more used in vet medicine and then seeing horses on it. And so it's really exciting to kind of follow along with ways that you're using them and also improving not only their use, but the potential side effects. So yeah, I think that's great that ECIR is able to have such a large database and help so many horses, but also see the evidence of what's going on with so many horses.
Just had a woman post this morning on the group that she had her horse on carnitine to control this triglyceride levels, and she ran out or something like her supply got interrupted for some reason. She stopped. She had to stop it for a while. They went right back up, and they came right back down again as soon as the horse got back on it. So that's pretty good empirical evidence that it's definitely working.
Yeah, I actually did see that. And I sent a screenshot of that email comment to the owner of the horse that was so affected by going on the SGLT2 inhibitor. And she was really interested to know that there was something that somebody was using to help that. So that's so great. And I love that ECIR has the ability to help kind of fund some research into these kind of topics. So I know that this has been a focus, I think, the last few years of ECIR. So I didn't know if Dr. Gustafson, you can tell us more about that initiative for group research and independent research funding.
Sure. Yeah, it's been a goal for a long time to be able to fund research and especially independent research. So last year, we put out a call for proposals for a one-year study and got several good proposals and ultimately awarded the grant, our first grant, to Dr. Broher. And the reason we did that was because he was interested in studying why horses that are on SGLT2 inhibitors develop hypertriglyceridemia. So there were so many good proposals, but because Eleanor and I have published on both the effects of SGLT2 inhibitors and then we're first to report the high triglycerides, this just fell right into what the group as a whole is interested in. So that's why we funded that particular study. So he should be wrapping up this study within the next few months, and he's slated to present the results at the conference. So we're really excited by that.
That's great. And is that something that an equine professional can reach out if there's something that they're interested in looking into and apply for that kind of funding? Or is there that passed?
Yeah. Yeah, certainly anyone is available to, or anyone can apply. One of the restrictions with publishing that sort of thing are you need to have animal use committee approval. And those things can be accomplished outside of universities, too. So really anyone can apply for the research funding when we make it available. We didn't do it this year because the conference takes so much time and effort, and we just didn't have the time to devote to it. But we certainly plan on funding more studies in the future and hopefully for longer periods of time, like a two-year proposal. But that all depends on funding. We need the funds too. So that's part and parcel. What the conference is about is to help support research. And research is definitely one of our main initiatives. It's not just research studies, but it's also the education we provide through the group, through publications, through Facebook posts, the fact series, and those types of things. So we're always trying to have that research arm available to people who need help.
Yeah. And that's not the only, well, that is the only lecture that's going to be presented from that research source, but it's not the only lecture on SGLT2 inhibitors, correct?
Right.
Yeah. What are some of the, I mean, I know we kind of already talked a little bit about them, but what are some of the other topics that that will be touched upon for the medication, the drug use?
Dr. Sundra is going to present on ertugliflozin, which is something that got started on this side of the world a little later than it did in Australia and England. But we now have, that's also available now through Wedgwood Pharmacy as a compounded drug for horses.
Which drug is that again?
Ertugliflozin, Steglatro.
Okay.
We were using primarily canagliflozin, that's Invokana. That was the first one that we used. And a lot of our members' horses are still on that. So she's going to present about her experience with that drug. Although, from what I've talked to her, there's really no major difference between them. It seems the whole family has the same benefits and the same drawbacks. So until we get to the point where something becomes generic, there's not going to be really much reason to choose one over the other.
Right. And then you're doing presentations on the biochemistry, and you already talked a bit about the management.
Yeah, well, I'm going to cover all of the side effects, not just the triglycerides. Dive a little deeper into the biochemistry behind the triglycerides because We have many veterinarians that want to stop the drug immediately as soon as they see the triglycerides starting to go up. And actually, there was a publication quite a few years ago that described five horses that this particular author knew of that were hypertriglyceridemic for years and even had their liver enzymes elevated for years, and there were no consequences at all that he could tell. And that seems a lot closer to what we see with this drug than the hyperlipemia syndrome, where they are at very real risk of dying. So what I wanted to do is try to reassure people that their horse isn't going to drop dead the next day and give them some ways to counteract it, because we are pretty good at keeping it in control now.
Yeah, and I think that that is what, I mean, I don't know for sure, but I think some veterinarians, at least in my area, that makes them really nervous, and why they just pull the drug right away is they're not quite sure. You know, they don't want to end up having this horse die from what they're trying to treat it with. So I understand that. That'll be great to have more information and kind of really dive into what that looks like in terms of management once they're on something like this.
I think when you have that problem with the rapid weight loss, which really goes back to calories rather than the drug itself, anything the drug is directly doing, I think that's when they're in the most risk of becoming seriously ill. When you get that very rapid weight loss, and some of that is also dehydration, because all that glucose in the urine pulls out water. And if they're not compensating for that with extra salt, then the horse gets into trouble both with dehydration and massive fat loss. And they're a mess, literally. I mean, they develop colic, all kinds of problems. But even when they get to that point, if they make it to a full-service hospital, they're very easy to turn around. I know of two that were like that, that were allowed to get to that point of rapid weight loss and dehydration and massively elevated triglycerides, and they both made it.
Wow.
Within days, not, you know, weeks and weeks. Only takes about 2 days to see massive changes, and within 3 or 4 days they're discharged.
Wow.
Well, it's bad. It's definitely something you want to avoid, but it's not what some people think it is.
Right. Yeah, and I know that obviously, laminitis isn't just from high insulin. And I know that the ECIR group focuses on metabolic causes. And is the conference basically, is it split pretty evenly between topics on insulin versus PPID or other causes of laminitic concerns?
The baseline cause is always insulin in the case of a metabolic horse. But well, now Dr. Kellen can correct me on that, because it's easy for me to say that to some degree that's true, but
totally true.
Yeah. So yeah, that's where the focus is going to be, and not on other sources like endotoxemia and those types of laminitis. But we do have really well represented group of people. So. Dr. Norton is going to be speaking to the genetic risk in a subgroup of horses, Arabian horses. I think Dr. Schott is bringing a presentation on PPID and its link to human Parkinson's disease, which I think is especially important because even to this day, I hear so many misunderstandings about the actual cause and mechanisms and involved in PPID, and mostly among the lay people, but even veterinarians, I don't think, have a full grasp of what's actually going on. And I think his presentation is going to shed some new light on this.
You mentioned, too, that of all the cases of laminitis, well over 90% are metabolic.
Yeah.
Or endocrinopathic, or whatever you want to call it. The rest are, incidental causes, accidental causes, not part of the animal's basic makeup.
Right.
And
I'll say, I have people reach out to me that I feel like they always assume that their horse is in that 10%. You're like, oh, my horse isn't metabolic. I can just tell. Or like, oh, my horse is, you know, they don't look metabolic, or they're not, you know, whatever, X, Y, and Z. And, you know, that's why I so appreciate the education from ECIR and getting the diagnosis and doing the blood work first and really knowing, because otherwise just guessing at what's causing the laminitis is not going to get you very far in many cases. But yeah.
So one of the other speakers on PPID and the reason we invited her was because she published a paper, I think it was last year, on different factors that affect ACTH concentration and those implications for diagnosing PPID. And what she did is she had a large group of horses that she divided into like clinical PPID, subclinical, and no diagnosis. In other words, not necessarily control group, but there was no suggestion of PPID. And she looked at them every month of the year and followed these horses so that she could kind of establish what factors affect ACTH. I think with EMS and especially PPID, as PPID because it's a progressive disorder, it's difficult to diagnose in the early stages. And, you know, you get a lot of false positives and false negatives, and depending on the season and the type of test that is used and the age of the horse and on and on and on. And, you know, I've seen everything from people treating EMS with Pergolide, which is not appropriate, but there are different ways to treat PPID, different medications. I think we're going to go into that. And then also, you know, how is it diagnosed and what are some adaptations to the medication protocols that could be used based on differences in seasons and how the horse responds and those types of things.
Yeah, and I saw that too. And I think that's super interesting because I think that there's sort of like this state where you're in where you know enough to be dangerous in terms of how everything works. Because even for me, I feel like I've been looking into ACT, or not ACTH, looking into metabolic issues with the horses for years and years. And even talking earlier about its relation to Parkinson's in humans, I couldn't even begin to talk about that. There's so much more that I want to learn and know. So it's awesome to see more of those kind of topics, diving into the nitty gritty. It's obviously, you know, I love that it has all of those topics that are really in depth in the sort of nitty gritty of the medical side of things. But I saw that, you know, there's also more of a look at how owners are kind of handling these diagnoses and handling working through rehabbing their horse or getting their horse to a healthier spot. I don't know if you could dive into that at all, of what that looks like in terms of those presentations.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's really every presentation. I mean, this conference has been like a one-room schoolhouse since the beginning with, you know, health professionals, veterinary professionals, and owners. And we're very used to speaking primarily to owners, but we can present the material in a way that is understood, I think. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have a veterinary degree to understand any of these presentations. Yeah. Now, we might give you details on a specific piece of physiology, but you don't have to know the whole physiology of the horse to understand it.
Right.
We just try to make things come alive factually for everyone in the audience. And it's always been like that.
Yeah.
And the group is like that.
Exactly. Yeah. I think this year we have this, you know, this is our 25th anniversary of the ECIR group. So that's the timing of this conference was planned around that. But the range of speakers we had this year, I think, are just really remarkable. And that's what allowed us to put out 21 hours of continuing education credit for veterinarians and other groups. But specific to your question, I think you're talking about Dr. Gottschang with Smith University. And she approached us, I think it was last year or the year before, about asking if she could survey owners of horses with metabolic disorders to understand more about how they cope with things. And we thought that was a great idea. So she did a research study and surveyed these owners, and she'll be presenting that here. And I think that's it's not medical or anything, but because the owner is actually the face of caring for these animals. The veterinarians come in, they do their diagnosis, they may prescribe drugs, and then they go off to the next case. But the owner's left with a fairly difficult management situation that can involve everything from hoof care to dealing with laminitis pain to new medications and their side effects to nutrition, and it just goes on and on and on, and it's just so overwhelming. And I think that's the strength of the ECIR group, is that we have been here for 25 years for the owners for support and encouragement and fact-based information. But I think it would be good too for the veterinarians to hear this from an outside person who's actually trained to do these types of surveys and understand more about, you know, what humans do when they're faced with these overwhelming situations and how they react to it.
Absolutely. And honestly, I so appreciate the ECIR group, because I'm in the trenches with a lot of these owners who are dealing with a sore horse and seeing them deal with that heartbreak and stress and anxiety going through it, and having a place to refer them to is wonderful, where it's not just, you know, the two of us trying to get through this. Because a lot of times, you know, it's really the owner feels so isolated, but then they have thousands of people that can speak to going through a similar experience online. But, you know, it's you form that community that can help each other through those kind of things. So it's really great to kind of tap into what those owners might be struggling with and know that, you know, nobody's alone in that kind of situation.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, I think all the topics look so exciting. I'm really, really excited this year to be attending and learn more, especially because last year, actually a year ago from when the ECIR conference will be, Dr. Rendell came in and gave some talks at the PHCP conference, and he was talking about the different flows and drugs and different management for insulin resistance versus PPID, and hearing the latest research and how much more is going into researching this has been very exciting, just to get it more mainstream and not just feel like you're going up against a wall when you're trying new things with, you know, the veterinarian you're with or the hoof care provider or the owner. Now there's actually more research is actually being published where you can see that these things have been tried, and it's not just trying to convince a protocol to go into place. So that's really great that there's so much more research to present.
Exactly. I did want to touch on, we're going to have a couple of presentations on nutrition and carbohydrates. And you probably know that we've been, as a group, been pushing the term hydrolyzable carbohydrates for a couple of years.
Yeah.
And, you know, we want to keep pushing this because meaning the scientific community, the plant biologists, the nutritionists, et cetera, have been using laboratory terms to describe, which perfectly acceptable, like a non-structural carbohydrate, NSC, for example. I mean, that is the correct term. But to apply that terminology to equine physiology is probably more confusing to the average person, especially since some of these laboratory methods are sums. You know, you have to add WSC and starch, and WSC is two things, you know, or more than two things. And you know, like I said, the owners are overwhelmed, and then they get these lab results, and we're telling them all about the sums and the what this, that, and the other, and this test, and you subtract this from this, and you get that. And, you know, they're already confused. So over 20 years ago, Hoffman published has chapters and papers on using equine physiology terms to understand better how these affect horses. And so she proposes, you know, using fermentable carbohydrates and hydrolyzable carbohydrates. And so that's why we're really trying to push this. And that is the correct term if you're trying to understand the effect of hydrolyzable carbohydrates on glucose and insulin production. So we're going to be talking about that. Dr. Kagan is going to present a presentation on different grasses, cool season grasses, and she may touch a little bit on warm season grasses, but talking about how the factors that influence how these plants take up carbohydrates, and hopefully that'll help people understand more about what's actually in there and what portion of those carbohydrates will affect glucose and insulin production in their horse.
Yeah, absolutely. And we actually recorded a podcast episode last week with Dr. Kellen and others at Mad Barn, and we did talk about HC, the hydrolyzable carbohydrates, a little bit.
I didn't just want to mention, it's just a little thing, but even some of the plant terms are incorrect, because WSC is not sugars.
Right.
So I see that time and time and time again on hay analysis reports.
Yes.
They say ESC sugars and WSC sugars. Mm-hmm. Fructan is not a sugar any more than starch is a sugar. Starch is a chain of glucose units, but nobody calls that a sugar. And fructan is a chain of fructose with one glucose at the end. And for some reason, that gets called a sugar.
Exactly.
And it's just plain wrong. It's not a sugar.
There's another lab report that I've seen that says NSC, and then in parentheses, they put WSC plus starch. And then right below that line, they write NSC, and in parentheses, put ESC plus starch.
Oh, my goodness.
It can't be both.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, drives me nuts. No wonder people are confused.
Yeah. And so just to clarify, so people listening understand, this is a fully remote conference.
It's a virtual conference. They need to have access to Zoom. If they want continuing education credits, they must be present. In other words, they have to log on and be there watching to get the credit.
Is it available after, if, say, someone's not getting credit and they don't have the time that during the conference?
If you're a vet, you have to be logged in.
Yeah, right.
If you're not a vet, you can watch later, yes. And everybody gets 6 months of recordings post-conference.
Yeah, that's what I meant. It's not for credit, but if somebody couldn't attend, then
yes.
Vets have to be logged. It's a lot for vets. It's a live conference.
Yeah,
that makes sense. All right. Well, thank you so much for letting me steal some more of your time, and I appreciate you being willing to share some of the things that are going to be happening at the conference. So, thank you so much.
We appreciate
anytime.
Okay. Thank you.
Have a nice day.
See you.
Bye bye.
I always say that I'm slightly more hoof-obsessed than the average person, and chances are, if you're listening to a hoof care podcast, you are too, so we should probably be friends. Feel free to find me on Facebook or email me at thehumblehoof@gmail.com.